Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals, Kant provides you with several different formulations of his main moral principle, the categorical imperative. This is the first formulation: act only on that maxim through which you can at the same time will, that it should be a universal law. And he tells you about it in general. He also gives you four specific examples about how this would apply in terms of strict duties to others, meritorious or wide duties to others, strict duties to the self, and then meritorious duties to the self. Remember, the difference between strict and meritorious is strict duties are duties that, in order to be a moral person, you have to do, you have to comply with. And so to fail to do a strict duty, to fail to choose a strict duty, is worthy of blame. A meritorious duty is not incumbent upon one with the same amount of strength or rigor. So if you didn't do it, it wouldn't be a good thing, but you're not morally bad for not doing it, you're just not morally good. It would be better for you to do it than not to do it. Now, Kant gives you a number of examples of his own, but I think that if we're going to think about Kant's ethics, it's often helpful to come up with our own examples and then see how these would apply. And Kant's first formulation of the categorical imperative is really, for a lot of these examples, not as easy to apply as you'd like it to be. You'll find that the second formulation that has to do with treating people, or rather treating humanity, as an end rather than just a means alone, actually clarifies a lot of these. But let's try to work our way through these. I've put together sort of a list of different ones that we can look at. Let's try to work our way through them and see just how far we can get with them. And that'll show us, to some extent, how applicable this general principle, which Kant thinks is the sort of, you know, touchstone for morality, how applicable that really is. So one of the big moral issues that you can think about has to do with killing another human being. Now, Kant talked about whether it's morally permissible to kill oneself, and he concluded that you have a strict duty to yourself to maintain your own life. So suicide is out of the question. What about killing another person? And there we would want to look at the maxim that's involved. You know, maybe there's a difference between callously going up to another person and saying, I'd like to see, you know, what happens when I kill this person, you know, out of, say, curiosity or sociopathy, right? And killing somebody, say, for material gain, or killing somebody motivated by revenge, or let's say killing somebody in order to protect other innocent people from being killed by that person, or killing somebody in a case of clear self-defense. These don't all necessarily involve the same maxim. It is the same action in a certain extent. A person is being killed, or it's being proposed that I should kill this person. And the person who's about to do that is asking themselves, would it be moral for me to do so? Would it be right for me to do so? So let's take some really easy cases. Let's start with, I have nothing against this particular person. I don't even know who they are. There's actually this case that's brought up in an article called The Case of the Obliging Stranger. So I go up to somebody on the street and I say, hey, I've got an experiment. I'd like you to help me out with it. Would you come along with me? And the obliging stranger says, why, yes, of course, anything for science's sake. And I bring them into my house, and I hit them on the head with a hammer and knock them out, and then I put them into an oven and turn the oven on, and they die as a result. Now, the writer of that, William Gass, says, any moral theory that is worth anything had better tell you that that's wrong. So the question is, and Gass points this out, well, what's wrong with it precisely? So what Kant would say in a case like that is, in terms of the categorical imperative, you can ask, what's the maxim here? And it would be something along the lines of, anytime that I decide I would like to kill somebody, I will kill that person, even if I have no reason to do so. And now, can we make that into a universal law of nature? Can we say, everybody shall do that? Kant would probably have no trouble saying, if you think that through, that can't possibly work. Why? Well, you could look at it in a couple different ways. One of the ways I think that would be most promising would be to say, what are you doing in a case like that? What does a world like that look like? It becomes totally capricious. People are killing each other sort of, you know, for no reason whatsoever. They're taking away one of the most, you know, valuable things, the very capacity to actually do anything, to feel anything, to choose anything from other people. They're making that into a universal condition. Well, if that's the case, then humanity just sort of disappears. Because sooner or later, everybody wants to kill somebody, I suppose. So that makes it sound a little consequentialist, though. Is there anything inherently contradictory, self-contradictory, in imagining a situation like that where anybody at any time, for no reason whatsoever, may choose, and once they start to do choose that, they follow through on it and they kill other people? Is there any sort of inherent contradiction in that? I think there is, if you actually start thinking it through. What about some other cases that are a little bit stickier, we might say? What about killing somebody for hire? In a way, the maxim for that is a lot easier to wrap your head around. Anytime that it shall be useful to me, or I will gain something out of it, I will kill another person. So it could be, you know, becoming a contract killer. It could be benefiting from somebody's death because they are no longer in your job that you want to have. It could be that they're a financial rival to you. It could be that you're going to inherit their wealth. So the general principle is anytime that I have some sort of gain from it, I will kill another person. Now imagine again a world in which this is the rule for everybody. And it's not just a rule like, well, you should do this. It's a rule that everybody does do that. What would that world be like? Well, it wouldn't be a world that's got a high population, for one thing. Because theoretically, I mean, if you think it through, everybody could kill everybody to get something out of them, if only to take what they've got. And then think about the point of having things, the point of financial gain. Financial gain is ultimately not, you know, valuable in itself. It's valuable insofar as it leads to the amenities of life or to a better life or something like that. So life would be, in a sense, canceling out life in the process. So you would have a contradiction there, at least from a Kantian perspective, right? Again, we're sticking with Kant here. This isn't necessarily what I think. This is the way a Kantian would have to see it. What about self-defense? What about cases where somebody kills another person in order to either defend themselves or to defend other innocent people? Now, Kant actually does discuss this, not in this work, but in The Metaphysical Elements of Justice. And he says you can't actually legitimately kill somebody in self-defense who hasn't done anything to you. But now let's imagine an aggressor. Somebody has already knocked you down, they're standing over you, and they say to you, I'm gonna kill you. You happen to have a sharpened screwdriver. No, this is a regular screwdriver, they're sharp enough, in your tool belt, and you can jam it up into them, and you actually know that if you hit them, you know, in the right place and screw it around, you're probably gonna kill them. Is it okay for you to do that? Is it the right thing to do? Well, again, let's think about what the maxim would be in a case like that. In order to protect my own life, when there is no other alternative, because of the actions of an aggressor who has imposed this upon me, I will take the life of the aggressor. Okay, that's a fairly decent way of putting it. Can we make that into a universal law? Could you have a world in which that was, in fact, the way things work? I don't see any problem cognizing or imagining that. Imagine a world in which any time that somebody else, we'll call them X, goes so far as to impose on Y the situation, either kill or be killed, and you can't escape from it, person Y kills person X. Well, you could easily have a case where nobody does that. There's no inherent contradiction involved in thinking of a world like that. Could you will a world like that? I don't think there would actually even be a problem in necessarily willing a world like that, where if an aggressor imposes upon the, I suppose you'd call them the aggressee, the subject of aggression, or the object of aggression, a choice, a stark choice, kill or be killed. And, it you know, they leave them no third alternative. You know, the person talks to them, don't make me do this. And they say, but I want to, right? If they force that, does it make sense to will that in cases like that, the other person should kill them? I don't see any problem with willing that from a conscient perspective either. It's not as if you'd be willing a world in which your will would in some way be contradictory. You're actually willing that justice be done in a certain sense. And if you extend this to protecting innocent people, you might actually need that protection. So long as you don't choose to become an aggressor, there doesn't seem to be any problem with this. If you, in fact, had a motive in your will and you say, I love hurting people, I love killing people, I want a world in which I get to do that, well, then that wouldn't be for you. But we've already seen that's not a moral perspective, right? So self-defense seems like it would be licit or allowable from a conscient perspective. If you're dealing with other people, perhaps there's actually a duty to protect them, other innocents, that you can do that in the face of aggression. Is there anything else to be said about this? I think there's two other things that we could say about this. Now, if you're going to resist aggression with deadly force, potentially deadly force, are there any limits on that force? I think you could say there's two ways of looking at this, again, from a conscient perspective, where the categorical imperative could apply and it could make sense to limit it. One would be the threshold that an aggressor or a potential aggressor or possible aggressor has to cross before you actually trigger some sort of response. I don't think that you could justify something like a preemptive strike against somebody where it's kind of iffy from a conscient perspective. Because again, what would a world be like where we all did that? Oh, you might be coming after me, so I'm gonna get you. That's not going to satisfy this requirement. You're not going to be able to make that into a coherent world picture. As a matter of fact, what does that lead to? Something very much like Hobbes' imaginary war of all against all state of nature, in which life is nasty, brutish, and short, as he puts it, and becomes almost inconceivable when you push it far enough. That's one thing. What about this now? Let's say you have the capacity to use what is, you know, likely going to be deadly force, but could be used in a non-deadly way. For instance, do you shoot to kill, you know, center of mass or right in the head, or do you try to incapacitate an opponent? Now, of course, this assumes that you actually have that sort of possibility. But let's say you do have that possibility. Do you have a duty then to the aggressor not to kill them, but rather to incapacitate or to render them unable to follow through on their intent to kill you or harm you? I think if you're going to make a case for that, the best that you could get would be a meritorious duty. So a police officer, for example, faced with a dangerous criminal who's already, you know, exhibited the intent to use deadly force against innocents who the police is protecting and against the police officer, would Kant say they have a moral obligation, a strict duty to shoot to incapacitate? I don't think so. Do they have a meritorious duty to try to keep that person from dying by shooting them, say, in the leg and incapacitating them? I think Kant would be willing to say they have a meritorious duty to that. And we could go through the categorical imperative, but I want to keep this rolling along in order to do that. What about duty to yourself? Do you have a duty to yourself to protect yourself? Well, do you have a strict duty to yourself to preserve your own life in the face of another's aggression, if that means that you have to take their life? Let's see again, can we universalize that? Anytime that somebody will begin to threaten me with deadly force, I will use deadly force against them. Can that be made into a universal law? Can we imagine a world in which that takes place? Yes, we can in fact imagine a world in which that takes place. Can I will that be the case? Well, we examined that before. I don't see myself, maybe somebody else, you know, who's more of a conscient than I am would point this out to me. I don't see any inherent discrepancy or contradiction or you know, problematic status of willing that world either. If we said something like, if the maxim was something like, anytime somebody seems to threaten me, I'll go after him, yeah, then we wouldn't want to will that. But if we qualify it and we say, anytime that somebody is clearly using deadly force against me, I will use deadly force against them to try to protect myself, I think we can will that. So that means that we've got something that actually is a moral duty. You have a maxim that you can act upon that you can will to be a universal law in that case. Let's move on to something else. Let's think about giving fair verdicts. There's a really interesting law in the Old Testament, in the Torah. I think it might be in Leviticus, where it's actually instructing judges that they are not to pervert justice. And they're not to pervert it in two different ways. They're not to give unfair verdicts to the rich because the rich bribe them or, you know, overawe them or they favor them for some reason. They're also not to give unfair verdicts to the poor out of pity or sympathy for them, because that can also skew that. In a sense, that's a very Kantian way of looking at it. Not material gain or prestige, and not being moved by sympathy either, but sticking to justice. Now, let's say a judge actually says to themselves, I am tempted to give an unfair verdict. Would it be okay for me to do so? So now, what would the maxim be? Well, let's say it's the rich person. When a rich person bribes me, or, you know, when I derive some financial gain from it, I will render an unfair verdict. I will contravene justice. Now let's say the maxim is something like, when I feel sympathy for the person who is before me, I will give them an unfair verdict, which favors them over the other person. Imagine a world in which that becomes the norm, and not just the norm in the sense that this happens most of the time, but this happens in every single case. So every single time that a judge has some financial motive or is moved by sympathy, they render an unfair verdict. Would it make sense to even have a system of justice in that case? What is the guiding idea of a system of justice? These two people, you know, can't actually decide, or whatever, two sides can't actually decide on what counts as fair, so they appeal to a third person, a third party, who is supposed to be impartial and render justice one side or the other, or perhaps, you know, splitting it down the middle. Well, if we said that every time that a person has something to gain from it or is being moved by their emotions, they should render an unfair verdict, the whole system of justice would no longer even make sense. It's not just that it would, like, collapse empirically, rationally, it wouldn't even make sense. You'd be undoing it. So you actually have a strict duty to be fair when giving verdicts. Let's talk about, I have a lot of examples here, but I want to keep this fairly short. Let's talk about insulting or offending others now. Do you have a duty not to insult or offend others? This is a very important one to think about, because there's a lot of ways in which it's easy, especially in the kind of societies that we tend to live in now, where people are coming from all different backgrounds, have all different points of view, where it can be quite easy to offend somebody without even necessarily meaning to. And once you've offended them, then maybe you have to think about, well, am I going to continue to do this thing that actually offends them, or am I not going to do that? Am I going to refrain from it from now on? And this isn't just an issue in heterogeneous societies. Even in fairly homogeneous societies, if you, you know, look at literature, people find ways to offend each other because we have all sorts of different roles. We occupy different spaces. We have lots of ways to misunderstand each other. And we're all, you know, to some degree, about some things, sensitive. So let's think about what the maxim could be in a case like that. I'm in a situation. I know that saying a certain thing, let's make it a joke, right? I'm tempted to make a joke, and yet I know that joke will probably be offensive to one of the people in the room. It will cause them some psychological pain, maybe make them feel less valuable, humiliated in comparison to the other people in the room. And it might actually make the other people, you know, they might say, yeah, that's a great joke. I enjoy that, right? Is it okay for me to do that? Or do I have a duty to refrain from that sort of thing? Well, what's the maxim? In situations where I can either offend or not offend another person, I will give them offense. That could be the maxim. It could be something along the lines of whenever it will give me pleasure and give other people pleasure, I will inflict displeasure upon another person, or perhaps even humiliation on another person by offending them. Let's use that one. So whenever it's pleasant for me and perhaps for other people, I will impose displeasure and perhaps humiliation on another person. Let's say that becomes the world, the norm. Can you imagine a world like that and think it through? Would there be any inherent contradictions in a world like that? I don't think so. I think you can imagine a world like that quite coherently. You know, we're all like Don Rickles going around zinging each other or something like that. Would you will such a world? Would you, if you really are honest with yourself, and I know there's some people that would be like, yeah, sounds great, screw everybody else. But would it really make sense to will a world like that? No, it wouldn't. So I think you can say that there's actually a meritorious duty involved here to others not to offend or to insult them, not to give them offense. Now, you know, could there be any sort of corresponding duty? And I'm not going to go very deep into this, but could there be any other corresponding duty to oneself or to other people not to take undue offense, not to be too prickly, not to be too easily offended? I'm willing to bet that from a Kantian perspective, if we thought this out, there would be. You know, I'm reminded very much of this saying by St. Francis de Sales, which talks about scandal. Scandal means taking offense at somebody else's actions or words or something like that, allowing oneself to be offended. Literally a stumbling block, a scandalon. And St. Francis says that, now there's a very extreme view, he says, those who commit scandal commit spiritual murder, but those who allow themselves to be scandalized too easily or for the wrong reasons actually commit spiritual suicide. I think there's something to that. I think that there's some sort of a reciprocal relation between allowing oneself to be offended too easily and the people who offend. Let's move on to look at a few others, some other examples. Fidelity in marriage. This is an interesting one. Originally, when I thought this through, I thought in terms of like cheating, you know, like committing adultery. And it doesn't necessarily have to be marriage. It could be any sort of committed relationship where there's an expectation of monogamy. But cheating can cover a lot of different things. And, you know, we talk about emotional affairs. Actually, in the South, you can sue somebody for what they call estrangement of affection. If you catch them, you know, that one I think you actually do have to have some cheating involved. But, you know, the idea of estrangement of affection from the one person who you're supposed to be affectionate with to another person. Because there's some sort of promise being made. There's some sort of commitment being made. There's another modality of cheating as well, what we call financial infidelity. If you have a household in which people have actually merged things, and this is the way marriages, you know, typically work, and one person is deceiving the other as to, you know, where they actually stand, where the fruits of their labors are going, then you can have, you know, running up credit card bills, for example, that the other person doesn't know about. This happens quite frequently. You've got financial infidelity. So you can have infidelity in a lot of different ways. Let's say we think in terms of just, you know, general, I've made a commitment to somebody and I'm going to break that commitment while I'm still involved with them. So what would the maxim be? Because it suits me, even though the other person is committed to me in the relationship that we have formed, I will, while drawing upon that relationship, deceive them and not do what's required of me in that relationship. I will transgress that relationship. Okay, let's make that into a universal law now. Everybody does that in every relationship. Does that make sense? That's a pretty easy one. Is there any point in having relationships then? The entire notion of committed relationship then just sort of becomes defunct. So that's a pretty good case for, you know, this first formulation of the categorical imperative. Kant would say, you have a strict duty if you enter into some sort of relationship like that. And, you know, it's got different dimensions. So sexual, in terms of affection or perhaps even respect of the other person. Financial, maybe we look at other dimensions as well. Maybe there's a lot more to it. Once you've entered into a relationship like that, Kant would say you actually have a duty to your partner, and that person has a duty towards you as well, not to engage in infidelity, to be faithful, if we want to put it in more positive terms. They have a duty of fidelity to you. We've talked a lot about duties to others. We talked a little bit about duties to self. Now let's think about some examples that have much more to do with the self. Here's one that Kant doesn't consider as such in the groundwork. He asks about, you know, is it okay to kill yourself or shorten your life, you know, to make your life less unpleasant? And he says no about that. What about providing for yourself? He talks about the need to cultivate your talents. But what about actually providing for yourself? Like, think about something really prosaic. What about, do you have a duty to, say, provide for your retirement? That's a really concrete kind of thing that we all have to, if we live long enough, worry about, or at least concern ourselves with. Can we fit that into Kant's categorical imperative and make it do its job and tell us, do we actually have a duty to provide for ourselves or don't we? Let's say somebody is tempted to say, screw it, you know, other people will take care of me, or there'll be some sort of governmental safety net, or, you know, something will come along and do it. So I'm not going to set any money aside for retirement. I could do it, you know, my employer has a plan and they'll make these contributions if I make contributions, but screw it. I want to use the money now to do the sort of things that I like. So what's the maxim there? It's something along the lines of, in order that I enjoy my time now, I will not set aside the resources to take care of myself, to make sure that I'm not a undue, unfair burden upon other people in the future. Now, imagine a world in which that is the norm. Could you imagine a world in which that is the norm? I think that is imaginable. I think that there's no inherent contradiction in conceiving of such a world. Is there? Yeah, that's worth thinking about. The maxim is that everybody shall, for the sake of shorter term enjoyment, refrain from making any sort of provision for the future that's to come. Yeah, I think there's no inherent contradiction there. Would you will such a world? So now imagine a world in which everybody else does this, which means that you are yourself at some point in time going to have to either, you know, say, well, they're all just going to die, or you have to take care of them. And think about it this way. You're going to have to take care of some other people who said, not going to worry about the future. I'll just go on the dole and suck, you know, off of everybody else, and they'll all contribute to it. You'll have to contribute to that before they do. Then later on, you'll be saying that to other people. There is the risk, of course, too, in this world that everybody else says, tough, you didn't put anything aside, screw you, we're not going to take care of you. Would it make sense to will such a world? It wouldn't really make sense to will such a world. So even though you can conceive of a world fitting that maxim, That wouldn't make sense. That means that there's a meritorious duty involved, a meritorious duty to take care of yourself, to provide for yourself, to make sure that you are taken care of, that you have the resources that you need in the future, at least to intend it, not necessarily to make it happen. I mean, you could say, well, what if it's impossible for you? Well, you know, if it's impossible for you, that doesn't mean that you didn't intend it. That just means that it circumstances didn't work out that way. I'm going to cut off here. There's a lot of other examples that we could possibly think of for this categorical imperative, this formulation of it. But hopefully this has helped you to understand how a Kantian might approach some of these other issues. And now you've got a better handle on how to apply this kind of tricky formula or way of thinking about things.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.